Okay, well, I'm going to be talking about the results from the Wilkinson Microwave Anisotropy Probe. So I've got a few websites up here. You've probably seen many of them. So let's start off by telling you what I'm going to tell you. Okay, first thing is that the map has been renamed in honor of David T. Wilkinson. Okay, he was working on a project from the beginning, died in September of 2002. He was one of the boys that got scooped when Dickey said, "Boys, we've been scooped." And he's been working on the CMB ever since. So maps and power spectra have been released. The big surprise is we picked up the temperature polarization signal. That's not a big surprise. Big surprise is the amplitude, which is fairly large, indicating an optical depth of recombination, you know, since reionization of 17%. And so that implies that reionization redshift was approximately 17 or 20, depending on your ionization history, and the time is approximately 180 million years after the Big Bang. Again, what we measure is the optical depth. The rest of it's derived. Lambda CDM is a good fit to the power spectrum.
If there's more than one epoch of reionization, does that conclusion about the redshift change?
The conclusion about the redshift does change. You know, if you have XE is a function of redshift that you want to play around with, then what you need to do is integrate, you know, NE naught times 1 plus Z cubed times your XE times CDT times the Thompson scattering cross section until you get to this optical depth. And then, you know, whatever you put in for your XE of Z is going to affect the redshift. So that's definitely in effect. So a little introduction, the COBE satellite had several experiments on board, one of which measured the spectrum. So the spectrum's very black, and it also had an anisotropy experiment on board. And the COBE DMR results are summarized in this slide. So fundamental facts about the microwave background, it's very uniform. So without contrast enhancement, you can't see any structure. 400 times contrast enhancement, you can see the dipole anisotropy, and then you can see the Milky Way. The Milky Way is showing up red, indicating it's a low frequency signal compared to the microwave background. If we remove the dipole, then we can expand the contrast to 2,000 times, and that's what we get here. There are now some gray smudgy stuff off the plane. Gray in this plot means that it's got a color that's consistent with equal delta T in all bands. So that's consistent with the microwave background. And then if we subtract off a fraction of the red map, in this case 31 gigahertz, from the high frequency maps, in this case 53 and 90 gigahertz, then we can remove this galactic signal, at least to first order, and then expand the contrast again. Now 30,000 times enhancement, and you can see the gray smudgy stuff now is a false color map. So in this map, red is hot and blue is cold, and that corresponds to high potential, gravitational potential, like being on top of a hill, that's red, and being down in a valley, having a low gravitational potential, that's blue, because it's the gravitational redshifts that's the dominant effect. Okay, the COBE view of the sky was blurry, so we weren't able to resolve what the universe was made of. But then, okay, let's see, we got enough room now. It was pretty clear that if you had a large, you know, better angular resolution, then you might be able to figure out what the secret of the universe was. Or you could just go to Kendall Square, Cambridge, and find it. So I'm going to be showing some diagrams that'll be conformal space-time diagrams. I don't want to lose people on the way. So here's a map of the Earth. By the way, it's got the correct red-blue color scheme on it for the COBE maps. High is, you know, mountains are red. And if you go on a southeast course from this point, then you have some curvy path But if you go on a Mercator chart, where you divide out by the convergence of the meridians towards the pole and stretch the latitude axis, then the southeast course becomes a 45-degree straight line. And here's a space-time diagram where the galaxies are moving away from us. And the light cone is this curvy thing. And if we do the same thing, divide out the expansion of the universe and stretch the time axis, then we get a conformal space-time diagram. There is a difference, of course, that, you know, for the standard hot Big Bang, this is finite depth here. Mercator chart goes to infinity. Okay. Well, on this space-time diagram, we can draw the behavior of two different fluids. There's two fluids in the universe that interact only gravitationally. One is the dark matter, which dominates the density. And so it's producing these red and blue spots by its gravitational potential. And in the blue spots, you can see matter is converging there. So that's where you're forming the large-scale structure. But because the dark matter doesn't have any collisions with itself in general, I mean, some people suppose that it might, but in the standard dark matter model, there's no collision, so there's no pressure, no velocity, it's cold, so the sound speed is zero. Whereas the other fluid is the baryons and the photons. And the photons, in this case, early in the history of the universe, provide both the pressure and the density, most of the density and all of the pressure. And the resulting sound speed is the speed of light divided by the square root of 3, so that's 170,000 kilometers per second. It's a pretty fast sound speed. And so on this diagram, the speed of light's a 45-degree angle, and the speed of sound is a pretty good angle. And if we take a particular wavelength that is set, essentially so that between the Big Bang and recombination there's half a period, then you can get what was originally a low-density region. Now, I've drawn the low-density region red for the dark matter because it's this gravitational potential that affects things, and that makes a high temperature. But it's this low-density region is blue for the baryon-photon fluid because, after all, low-density equals low temperature. So it's possible, with half a wavelength shift, to actually get the hotter or the denser and hotter material now lined up with the low gravitational potential, or the high gravitational potential, that is, being a hill. And so you end up then having a maximum in the amplitude of fluctuations. So the fluctuations peak at this particular wavelength, and they also peak at other wavelengths, you know, 3/2 wavelengths, 5/2 wavelengths, and so on. And the result is you get a bunch of oscillations at the this is the density contrast in the baryon-photon fluid. This is positive and negative, so it's flipped sign here. That's what I'm talking about, half a wavelength. It's going to flip sign. And then the dark matter, while this is going on, the dark matter stops growing as fast, but density contrast doesn't change. And then at different wavelengths, this is a short wavelength, and this is a long wavelength. A very long wavelength, everything stays pretty much in phase. So Kobe was looking at these wavelengths, and then it was clear that people definitely wanted to study these shorter wavelengths on the sky. So this is as a function of the size of the universe. That's a time in the history of the universe. And then we can take the density contrast at the surface of last scattering and plot that as a function of wave number. And that's shown here. So you get these oscillations in this density plus potential fluctuation. And that's what dominates the peakiness of the structure of the angular power spectrum. There's also a velocity term that produces just as much anisotropy as this density contrast term. But as I'll show you in a minute, it doesn't produce much in the way of peaks in the angular power spectrum, even though it oscillates. And there's a slightly ridiculously simple geometric reason for that. The potential survival, you know, versus k, the potential, if the potential is constant as a function here, this is equal power on all scales, the inflationary prediction, then the p of k that you're looking at for large-scale structure would be k to the 1 for all scales. But it's not. We know that it turns over goes through a peak and turns over. So when we're actually looking at clusters of galaxies, it's turned over, and that comes automatically out of here. You see the potential is dying away as a power law. So you go to short wavelengths, and this is all from Juro Seljak's paper, Two Fluid Approximation to CMB Anisotropy. It's sort of, you know, version 0.1 of CMB fast. So it's about 20% accurate. So here's a plane wave extending throughout all space. So imagine this is a three-dimensional plane wave. And then we can cut out the surface of last scattering, which is really a sphere, into that. And so then we can look at the projection of this plane wave on the surface of last scattering, and we get a map. Looks like this. And as you can see, at the equator, you have, for this particular value, k times the radius of last scattering of 50, then you basically have L equals 50 structure here. And you have low L structure here at the poles. But because the equator, you know, regions close to the equator have most of the solid angle, and also have L of approximately 50 throughout, then you get a fairly sharp peak at L of 50 when you analyze this, a cusp. But when you do the velocity term, the velocity, of course, is perpendicular to the line of sight at the equator, so the amplitude associated with the velocity term disappears here. So in the region where you get a sharp peak in the angular power spectrum, you don't have any power. And then we can take random plane waves, and it looks like some map with some structure at characteristic wavelength. And the same thing is true when you're looking at random spherical harmonics, all of the same L. And then you get the conversion from K to L. And as I pointed out, this density term gives you a sharp peak at L of approximately equal to K RLS, whereas the velocity term does not. So you don't get the sharp peak from the velocity term. So don't call them Doppler peaks, because the Doppler effect isn't what's causing them. So you get a large number of peaks here. So the 1/2, 3/2, 5/2 wavelengths. And there's a number of effects that can be measured. Four are very well determined. One is the overall amplitude of the anisotropy. One is the amplitude of the first peak and the amplitude of the second peak relative to this large equal power on all scales. Third is the spacing of the peaks, or the position of the first peak, whatever you want to refer to it as. Okay, so that's basically four things. So what we get from that, there's very well determined densities and a combination on the vacuum energy density and the curvature, both of which have no effect early in the history of the universe, but do affect the geometry and hence the angular size scale and the positions of these peaks. So, given the excitement of doing this, a lot of small scale experiments were done, one of which was done here, this one. This is the boomerang map. This is Saskatoon, which is probably the earliest of these. QMAP is Saskatoon on a balloon. And TOCO, which is the latest of that series, is Saskatoon on a truck. But basically, a lot of experiments have been done in order to measure the small angular scale, angular power spectrum of the microwave background. And this is the situation as of November 19, 2002. A couple of groups actually, well, Akbar published some new data, and Boomerang analyzed their data for the third time since then, and between then and the map release. But here are two fits that I did to this pre-map compilation. And basically, we have here a vacuum-dominated lambda CDM model in red, which has a Hubble constant of 68, vacuum energy density of 2/3 of the current density. It's a flat model. Has a baryon density. Little omega means capital omega H squared. So this is a real physical density. So you take this number and multiply it times 19 yoctograms per cubic meter, and you've got a real density. Okay. So then there's the standard CDM model, which has a Hubble constant of 47, so it's pretty close to the old-fashioned SCDM, and it's got a baryon density of 0.21 as opposed to 0.22. Now it does have a cold dark matter density that shifted a fair bit. So in the old compilation, this cold dark matter density was a little bit flexible. The baryon density was pretty well determined. What's going on here is you're messing with the matter density in order to adjust the peak position. Now that raises and lowers the amplitudes of the peaks, but the different peaks are all measured primarily by different experiments, and they all have their own calibration errors. So it's a little bit flexible. So now there's a new cosmology satellite after COBE. It's MAP. So this was proposed by the MAP Science Working Group, and there's Dave Wilkinson, and approved by NASA in the first MIDEX competition. So fairly short development time. Basically, we started thinking about MAP in 1994. I mean, sitting around in a snowmass meeting in 94, just trying to figure out what we should do with the next space experiment. And then there was a mission concept study opportunity from NASA, which we got money from, and then the MIDEX announcement. Got selected for a phase A study, and then one in the shootout. Okay, so the specifications for what we actually built are as follows. 30 times better angular resolution than COBE. The actual smallest beam size is 0.21, but we're scanning fast enough, so it's a little bit smeared. So let's say 0.25 versus 7 degrees. It has 45 times better sensitivity than COBE. So that means that we can cover all these extra beams. So that means, you know, basically in a given time interval, we're 45 times better sensitivity, so we can make the same number of observations in 2,000 times less time with the same sensitivity. So 2 years with MAP equals 4,000 years with COBE. So that's just a statement of how fast microwave technology has advanced. So you can really do a much better experiment. We're out at the Earth-Sun L2 point. When COBE was flying, we were annoyed by the Earth's magnetic field and emission from the Earth's limb. And we got rid of those. And so, and like COBE, we have a differential radiometer. We chop rapidly between widely separated beams. So the way we do the chopping is with a differential pseudocorrelation radiometer. Basic idea is you take input from two horns, A and B, and what you want, you know, these are voltages. So you want A squared minus B squared. That's the power difference between the two horns. The way we get that is to split the signals. You can ignore the OMT for now, but just come down to the magic T. It's just called T because they didn't want to put magic T there. And what that does is it generates A plus B and A minus B. And then those are individually amplified. So you have separate amplifiers with independent amplifier noise. And then multiplied together. And then you get A squared minus B squared. Okay, that's what you wanted. Now I just described a correlation radiometer. Only problem with the correlation radiometer at 90 gigahertz is you can't multiply that fast. So you need something that's able to operate that quickly, and that's what's called a quarter square multiplier. So you go through another T and split it all out again, phase switch, and do a differential thing. But it's basically a quarter square multiplier on a correlation radiometer. That's what the pseudocorrelation radiometer is. And it's a good design. Works fairly well. Now this is the most important part of the spacecraft, is the NED control. Every spacecraft needs to have a NED control. It's actually already worked, so I'm feeling much better now. There's a primary and a redundant NED control.
Or isn't
that
there?
Oh, it's a non-explosive device. So that's the wax actuators to let the solar array out.
Is that an appropriate description of you? Non-explosive.
That's right. I'm non-explosive. Okay, so we're out at L2. So here's the sun is, you know, way over there at the highway, at Lagoon Road or something. And then we're 1% further away from the sun than the Earth is, but we're on the Earth-Sun line. So that's the L2 point, second Lagrange point in the Earth-Sun system. It's 1.5 million kilometers away from the Earth. We went through three phasing loops so we could, you know, be phased just right to fly by the moon, quite close to the moon, only a couple thousand kilometers off the surface, and then get out to L2. Okay, this is the status on June 30th, 2001. And then after that, we went through the first phasing loop, second phasing loop, third phasing loop, and then swung by the moon here. So you can see the little kink in the radius versus time. That's the gravitational effect of the moon. Now these P1, P2, P3 are the these points, those are the perigees. And we would have burns, you know, little correction burns at the apogee, perigee, apogee, perigee. And then flew by the moon, then we had a mid-course correction. And after that mid-course correction, this is the attitude of the satellite. So we have the spin rate in green, that's the standard spin rate. This is the precession rate, that's the standard observing precession rate. And this is the sun angle, and that's the standard observing sun angle. So after the mid-course correction, we dropped into observing mode and stayed there continuously until we come to the first station-keeping maneuver. That's called SK0, station-keeping zero, or L2 insertion, whichever one you want to call it. And so we basically started being able to use the data for the maps, you know, somewhere out about here. So about a month before we actually nominally reached L2. As you can see, you very slowly crawl up to L2. So the scan pattern is in green for map. So we have a big spin circle, and then it precesses around a small circle. So the spin axis is always 22.5 degrees from the anti-sun. Here's the anti-sun. So the spin axis traces a circle here, but we actually observe this donut from 45 degrees from the sun to 90 degrees from the sun. From the anti-sun, excuse me. 90 degrees from the sun, 135 degrees from the sun, 45 degrees from the anti-sun. COBE observed a different donut with a small spin circle and a large precession circle. So COBE was always observing between 64 degrees and 124 degrees from the sun. And then there's this other project, Planck, which unfortunately does not have reaction wheels. And, you know, apparently to add $3 million reaction wheels to this billion-dollar project is more than ESA could possibly imagine, because they don't know which country should get the job to build it. But, you know, if Planck had a scan pattern like this, it would be a much better experiment. So this is the first map from WMAP. It's July 5th or 6th, day 186. And this is the K-band. Galactic Center is in here. And you can see the Milky Way. Indication that everything's working. Of course, this is taken during the phasing loop, so.
What is the structure that we see there?
Well, you can actually see the scan pattern here because it's not very, you know, this is only about an hour's worth of data. So you see that, the weaving? Yeah, that's the just the scan pattern coming in.
And then the, is that an answer ring of the?
Yeah, now this is, what happens here is you have the reference beam on a source. And so when we're actually making the maps for real, you know, if the reference beam's on a bright source, we don't use the data. So we always throw out bright sources when we're analyzing the maps, but we're also throwing out bright sources when we're making the maps. So we have different thresholds for those. So we have a scan pattern here that's centered on the anti-sun, and it's covering this donut on the first day, and then gradually the sun, Earth goes around the sun, or the sun goes around the sky, anyway, whatever you want to say. And then we close up this hole after 3 months, and by that time we've done 75% of the sky, and after 6 months we've done the whole sky. And here's a map, first closed map. You can see holes here where Jupiter and Saturn were. And then we kept on going in order to reobserve the parts of the sky where the planets were. And so now we've covered the whole sky twice, one full year, and that's the data that's being released. And that means every spot of the sky has been covered with good data. So now I'll just run through the frequencies. This is 22 gigahertz, the K-band. It's on a 250 minus, you know, plus or minus 250 microkelvin scale and thermodynamic temperature. And then 30 gigahertz, 40 gigahertz, 60 gigahertz, and 90 gigahertz. And you can see, went too far. You can see that the stuff off the galactic plane is pretty consistent from frequency to frequency while the galactic plane is changing. So that indicates we have a real cosmic signal, and we've got a lot of spectral information on the galactic signal. So we've done a maximum entropy method model to separate it into synchrotron, free, and dust components. And those components have templates that come from the Haslam map, the maps of the H-alpha emission corrected for dust extinction, and the dust extinction map, that's the SFD dust. And spectra that, for free, we know what the spectrum is. For the others, we have to guess. And so that's part of the guessing procedure. And then we can figure out how much of the galactic signal is from synchrotron, free, or dust, according to this model. And this is what we see. So 22 gigahertz, we don't see no dust. None of that's blue. This little funny thing here looks like a funny place for the galaxy to be. Well, that's Sen A, so that's not the galaxy.
But the yellow is green and...
Yellow is synchrotron plus free.
Yeah.
So synchrotron plus free gives you yellow.
The free is there.
Free is there. Synchrotron is there.
Oh, but you just said
there's no dust. And even at 40 gigahertz, there's very little dust.
So it's, the first one you showed was just the model at 22?
Yeah, this is the model at 22, and this is the model at 40. Okay, but now let's go look at some dust. This is the model at 90 gigahertz. Now it's really dusty. So the dust is contributing at high frequencies, not very much at low frequencies.
Is the scale the same in terms of...
Scales being adjusted so that the threshold on this is half of the 95th percentile of the sky. It's just adjusted so that the amount of sky covered by the galaxy is about the same in all of them. So this is something like 100 microkelvin to saturate, and this is something like 200 microkelvin to saturate, and this is a millikelvin to saturate.
So if you look off the plane, that's they cut out 20 degrees about the plane. Plot it again, what would you see in K band versus?
Well, you still don't see any dust. No, we don't see any need for spinning dust.
Right, but not just dust, but what is the galactic contamination like?
Oh, well, let me show you that. So this is the... Here we have 85% of the sky, and here we have 77% of the sky, the galactic contamination. This is the total power, the variance. And then the CMB anisotropy is here. This one is in the antenna temperature, so the CMB anisotropy is curving down. Dust shows a power law. Thermal dust, free is a power law. Synchrotron is almost a power.
Can you tell us what free means?
Free is electrons flying past protons. It's Bremsstrahlung radiation. So it's a transition from a free state to a free state. Okay, so if you throw out 23% of the sky, then your variance is dominated by a factor of 10 or more at the bottom here. And then we also have a chart showing the, as a function of L. So this contour diagram of the same thing as a function of L. So instead of just the total variance, this is the power broken out by L. So actually, at the first acoustic peak, you have 100-to-1 advantage between the CMB and the galaxy. So foregrounds aren't too desperate a problem.
In your previous plot, did you smooth the beam size, or what?
No, that was smooth to I think 1 degree or something. So we have all the beams on the same size. That's for the maximum entropy method. We need to smooth to a common beam.
Okay.
We also detected 208 radio sources, and we simulated the detection algorithm with some random maps, and we'd pick up 5 ± 4 peaks that weren't there. So it's 208 - 5 ± 4 is the number of real radio sources. Of those 208 radio sources, 203 of them actually have obvious 5 gigahertz associations, and 5 of them don't. So we can assume, without worrying, staying up late at night, that the 5 that don't have obvious associations are probably similar to the 5 that are in there by random, at random. And the ones that we do detect have a flat spectrum on average, so it's new to the zero. So here we've plotted the Q-band data from WMAP compared to K-band or Ka-band from other experiments. But because it's flat spectrum, it should be pretty much on the same scale. And so WMAP's over here. We detect brighter sources, which are rarer because we've mapped the whole sky. DAISY, VSA, and CBI have different levels of source contamination. So there's definitely a contradiction between DAISY and VSA, but not so necessarily CBI. CBI is different angular scales. It could be just that the shape of this curve is wrong. This is a model curve from Tofolotti et al. We can definitely tell you that the large fluxes between 1 and 10 Jansky's that's normalized wrong, have to bring it down by 35%. Okay. So here's our weights. You can still see holes here, but they've been filled in partially where the planets were.
Yeah, that was at Q. If you did the same analysis at K and Ka, point sources would be three.
Well, you can't see as many point sources at K and Ka because the beam's so damn big.
Some of them are brighter.
Yeah, but some are fainter. I mean, the average, we've got, the spectral index for all of these sources, or at least limits on the spectral index. So it's reasonable to just transfer from K to Q, but no.
Is it consistent?
Yeah. I mean, there's nothing hiding there. So anyway, here's where Jupiter and Saturn were once, and here's where Jupiter and Saturn were the second time we covered it. And here's where Mars moved along quite rapidly and so on. And again, you can see where we've cut out the observations for the reference beams in the plane. So that's this stuff at 45 degrees off the plane. So again, let's do the normal contrast CMB sky. There is a signal there, I promise. Okay, and with the dipole, 400 times the contrast, so a very gray dipole. And then the Milky Way is much narrower, lots more structure. And then if we remove this velocity of the solar system, which is the dipole, then we get this. This is K, Q, and W band, so it's the broad frequency range, 22, 40, and 90 gigahertz. And this gray stuff off the plane is real CMB. The other red stuff off the plane are real radio sources. So you got Virgo, 3C273, 3C279, 3C345, SEN-A. So if I just go back to those, you can see them. Okay, there's SEN-A. This is 3C345. And then we can take out the galaxy by subtracting a fraction of the low frequency maps and then construct a map like this. So now we have not quite as high a contrast as the COBE map because we've got more structure. We've gone to a smaller angular scale. The structure in the CMB is bigger, so we don't enhance the contrast quite as much. Galaxy's pretty much gone away, but notice that, we got this big hot spot here. We think that's real CMB, and this cold spot here, they're both sitting on the galactic plane, but we think those are real. Whereas this line of dots down the center is just bad subtraction of the Milky Way.
This blue in the center, is this the galactic center or not?
No, the galactic center's right here. That's the galactic center. The rest of the stuff is CMB. As far as we can tell, that's real.
Well, you have probably the largest subtraction around this region. So is it
correlated? Well, you have trouble with subtraction, but you know the subtraction problems are really right at b equals 0. I mean, you're not having problems at b equals 5. So here's the QVW is an RGB map. And you can see this cold area coming in towards the galactic center. It's there, you know, in the raw data.
Can you just say for clarity what the phrase bad subtraction means?
Well, what we're doing is an internal linear combination to subtract the Milky Way contribution. So what we do is we look at the overall spectrum of the Milky Way and develop a set of weights that will give us the microwave background delta T correctly normalized, but no response to the Milky Way, the average spectrum of the Milky Way. So those regions where you get that those dots have a lot of galactic emission, so a small error in the coefficients has a large effect. And also, they tend to have slightly different spectra because they're rather unusually energetic H2 regions and so on. So they're actually a different kind of source than what we see in, when we're doing the average over the Milky Way.
So there is some subjectivity involved, is that right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So even after you've done this subtraction, you don't analyze the whole sky. Mm-hmm. So you still throw out, you know, 20% of the sky before you start looking for cosmological signals. So here's the QVW is a red, green, blue map. So this is the high frequency channels now, and then there's that internal linear combination, no galaxy map. It's on the same scale, so if we rock back and forth, gray stuff off the galactic plane stays pretty much the same. So you definitely can do that subtraction, and then you also mask it out. So here we have a comparison to COBE, two comparisons to COBE. One is the COBE 90 gigahertz map and the map, WMAP 94 gigahertz map. We have much higher angular resolution. And then over here we have the COBE 53 gigahertz map, and then we have a linear combination of maps from MAP, 40 and 60 gigahertz combined, to give us a pseudo 53 gigahertz sensitivity, and then smooth to the DMR resolution. And these maps are very similar, except the COBE map's noisier. So this has a noise appropriate for measuring on this scale. We have a noise appropriate for measuring on a much smaller scale. When we do the smoothing, our noise is much lower. And there's a little thing here. This is OV236, a variable quasar that appears to have varied. Okay, so now I want to talk about the polarization measurements. So we got this gravitational potential that leads to the large-scale structure, but then we also have electrons in the universe, either sort of in the end of the surface of last scattering. Now you can imagine the surface of last scattering is where the optical depth of the universe, or e to the minus tau, is going from, say, a 0.75 to a quarter, you know, transitioning through a half. So when the optical depth is very high, the microwave background seen by the electrons is very isotropic. And in an isotropic field, electron scattering does not produce polarization. When the optical depth is very low, there's no scattering, and the absence of scattering does not produce polarization. So it's only for electrons that are just here, close to the end of last scattering, that see a slightly anisotropic sky, and yet there's still some optical depth that produce polarization. Or you can have electrons after the universe is reionized. This is shown at a redshift of about 7 up here. And they would then see an anisotropy corresponding to a large angular scale. This one is a small angular scale. And if we go to the top view of the same space-time diagram, we see this. So this large circle is our surface of last scattering. And this small circle is the surface of last scattering seen from A. You can see they're tangent, so they are definitely correlated, but they're not identical. And so if you have a hot spot over here, then that light comes up to A and comes to us and then is polarized this way. So you expect to have polarization vectors lined up around hot spots on an angular scale corresponding to this distance. So at the surface of last scattering, you'll have a small angular scale, and at reionization, you have a large angular scale. So again, a hot spot, you get the polarization lined up around it. A cold spot, you get the polarization going in towards it. Then you have these screwy patterns that would correspond to something that could not be produced by electron scattering. These are the famous B modes that people would like to measure for the, because it's a signal only from inflation, whereas this is a signal of stuff that's happening in the universe as we can actually see it. And so this is more ordinary physics, and this is more far out physics, but this signal is so small that nobody's seen it yet. So there's two groups have measured this pattern, that's WMAP and DAISY. Nobody's seen any contribution like this. So if we do a simulation, now this simulation required a three-dimensional structure. So you lay plane waves into the whole three space, because you need not just our surface of last scattering, but also the electron surface of last scattering. And then you can figure out the polarization, and then you can go through and analyze this. So this is a bunch of simulations I did with an optical depth of a tenth. This is for a redshift of last scattering of 15, at least in the Einstein de Sitter universe. And those would give you curves like these red curves for the correlation between the polarization and the temperature. This is just looking for the temperature polarization correlation and what's called the Q, Stokes parameter. But this is the Stokes parameter rotated so that the coordinates are aligned to the separation between the two pixels you're looking at. And when you do that, you get a nice pattern here. And then you can also look at the other polarization, which would be the screwy pattern. And you don't see any of that in the simulations. That would be the TU. So you do see the TQ, don't see the TU. And when you look at the map data, you see a TQ, and we don't see a TU. And the TQ that we do see is rather larger than what would correspond to 10% optical depth. So that's essentially the analysis that leads to the 17% optical depth.
What kind of bounds can you put on the absence of the B mode?
Absence of the B mode, rather weak. Certainly nobody would expect a correlated B mode. Okay, so it's certainly not interesting, but it's about a factor of two below what this signal is. It, you know, would be a pretty good bound. Okay, this is a four sigma detection for the TQ, but the TU would, you know, maybe a two sigma upper limit would be a factor of two below that. As far as the BB, you know, we don't expect a correlated B mode. As far as the BB, we can't see it. We can't even see the EE yet. We can't see the polarization correlated with the polarization because that's a very small signal. So then we're trying to correlate two very small noisy signals and not doing too well. So we can do a high signal noise signal correlated with a low signal noise ratio signal. So we're nowhere close to detecting the B modes.
If cosmic strings are produced during inflation, which a lot of people think is likely, then you do get B modes.
Well, also, cosmic strings produce anisotropy after the surface of last scattering. And we have a 20 plus sigma detection at the expected amplitude of the electron scattering signal from last scattering. That means the anisotropy that we see is the same as the anisotropy that the electron saw at Z of 900. So that means cosmic strings cannot be producing very much anisotropy. Maybe only a little tiny bit, but they can't be producing much. So this is showing the a separation of the polarization signal into a galactic term and an extra CMB term. This is the galactic foreground term, which is mainly synchrotron emission. And you can see that the, you know, right here we've got plus or minus a microkelvin or so of foreground. And then here, pretty small signal. It's not all that much, you know, this is also a pretty small signal. This is the one that's real, that we think is due to reionization.
So
Okay, so remember, it's a 4-sigma effect. I mean, that's...
what are the colors here?
Colors are correspond to different ways of getting rid of the galaxy. The black is just the sum of all the high-frequency channels, no fit, no subtraction. And then the blue, green, red are fits to different sets of bands. And then we got a synchrotron term and a CMB term. So you're fitting two different frequency components to the polarization temperature correlation as a function of frequency. One is a CMB spectrum, one is a synchrotron spectrum. And this is the correlation that you get from the synchrotron spectrum term, and this is the correlation you get from the CMB term. So.
If there was none of this, I'd see zero.
Yeah, you'd see zero here.
Is it significant that 180 degrees that the signal seems to be climbing?
No. You know, you have to look at that, and then you look at this, and you say, well, this is supposed to be all noise, so it's not significant. So statistically, it's not significant. Now, this is all a, you know, place where better signal noise will definitely help. So the argument for observing more years with MAP is, you know, one of the three strong legs it stands on is that you can do the polarization better.
So could you fiddle with the synchrotron model and make this all be foreground?
No, we tried a lot of fiddles, but no, it doesn't seem to be very have a very large effect on what we think is the CMB. So the CMB spectrum here is pretty much the same, whereas the foreground that we derive has changed a fair bit as we fiddle the models.
Are you assuming the synchrotron polarization is the same as the synchrotron amplitude?
No. We're just assuming that there's a synchrotron polarization signal that's got a power law, like nu to the minus 2.6, or nu to the minus 2.7, or nu to the minus 2.8. And we can try all those, and we get very slightly different CMB results and more difference on the galaxy results.
But are you assuming that the polarization index is the same all over the sky?
Yes.
So one index all over the sky?
One index over the sky for this, because, you know, the points that go into one of these bins here have, of course, come from all over the sky. So it's a little hard to, you know, it's possible to change that assumption. You could change that assumption, but you wouldn't be able to do the analysis this way. And then, since this is only a 4-sigma effect, you wouldn't have enough signal noise to actually derive any of the extra parameters that you would have in such a more elaborate model. So this is where lots more signal noise would help.
Right, but if you look at the amplitude data, not the colors, which the amplitude pull out the synchrotron compound, which I'm sure you do, you have strong evidence for one index over the whole sky?
No, we have strong evidence for a change in the index over the whole sky.
Right, well, I assume so. And then the question is, can you fiddle with that in any reasonable way?
No, you can't fiddle with that in any reasonable way to actually affect this very much. Okay, so this is pretty invariant. So for example, you know, here's the blue is the QVW with the KA used to subtract, basically. Whereas the black is the QVW just added together with no subtraction at all. So what you assume for the galaxy has very little effect here. But, you know, I mean, you can't really do this with just VW. I mean, we don't have enough integration time to just use the highest frequency channels. So it's definitely a place for more data. So here's this prediction for adiabatic fluctuations at the surface of last scattering. This is the small angle stuff as a function of multipole. So this is the TE angular power spectrum. We decided that since we were the first one to see it, we'd define the convention. And instead of multiplying by L times L plus 1, which then makes this thing rise and oscillate, we just multiply by 1 power of L, or L plus 1. And then it just oscillates. So that's easier to plot. And reionization is then this big kick up at very low L, not resolved in this binning, and then we get this quite consistent measurement of the expected scattering from surface of last scattering. So this is what we've basically seen. The reionization is lower down, though we don't actually measure this angle with any accuracy, but we get it lower down because we need to go this far down in order to get the optical depth we see. And then we do see the surface of last scattering polarization. Now this is very well measured, and this is a 4 sigma measurement. Okay, now what about the TT power spectrum? This is the main angular power spectrum of the anisotropy. We've decided to only publish results based on the cross power spectra. We have lots of channels. So what we're doing is just comparing a map with some other map with independent radiometer noise. And so we're only looking at the angular power spectrum of stuff that's consistent from map to map. And then we can plot this as a function of the frequency of the two combinations, two maps that we're comparing. And so we have 28 different combinations among the Q, V, and W radiometers. We have 2 Q-band, 2 V-band, and 4 W-band, so it's a total of 8 different radiometers. So there's 64 ways of taking pairs of them. 8 of them are diagonal, that's the auto power spectra. And then you have 28 in the upper triangle, 28 in the lower triangle, so that's the 28. When we compare the Q-band to the Q-band, we have a slightly higher power spectrum at high L, and this is from unresolved radio sources, the ones that are just fainter than what we could detect. So if we take a model for the external, extragalactic radio sources, assuming that our source counts of the ones we do detect is giving us an estimate for the source counts of the ones we just didn't detect, and also that the spectral index is 0, which is what we observed for the ones we did observe, then we can subtract that foreground model, and now all of them line up quite nicely.
Is that before subtraction of known radio sources? Or is this the entire?
No, the known radio sources are just cut out. So we've got.
This includes the cutout.
Yeah, so we've got all the little circles in the mask
and
for analyzing.
Is this what galactic latitude?
This is the. I don't know. I'd have to look. But it's KP0 or KP2. So it's either, it's around 80% of the sky. It's either 77% of the sky or 83% of the sky, depending on whether it's KP0 or KP2. So we have about 75% of the sky in these. Well, about 80%, sorry. So let me just show you what the fitting does. We can calculate a lot of different models that are consistent with the angular power spectrum. And so these are a bunch of 6-parameter models that I did to the pre-map compilation. And what we have plotted here is a Monte Carlo Markov chain. So these dots should be distributed consistent with the likelihood of the model. And so not a parameter, but one of the things you can derive from the parameter is the Hubble constant, so that's the color code on the dots. The supernova, let's see, here's the flat universe line, omega total of 1, and of course the supernovae like to be up here. I'll show a plot with the supernovae circles, ellipses on it. Okay, so this is what we had pre-map. So you have this degeneracy. This is the geometry of the universe. You got 2 parameters, curvature and vacuum energy density, describing it. We basically have one well-measured data point, and that's the position of the first peak or the spacing of the peaks. So we have a linear degeneracy. It's not, however, a degeneracy parallel to omega total. So it's a little skewed.
What was the best independent value for the Hubble constant?
Best independent value for the Hubble constant is around 72. That's from the Hubble key project. So if we replace COBE data by WMAP, now we have much less variability here. The width of the line has gotten a lot narrower. So that indicates we have a much better position for the first peak. So the position of the first peak is known to better than 0.5%. We still, however, have a large degeneracy. So we have this line of degeneracy. when we look at the densities, the baryon density and the cold dark matter density were moderately well determined pre-MAP. So the baryon density is about 15% accuracy. And this is the Big Bang nucleosynthesis values from D over H. And that's a 10% accuracy. Cold dark matter density is sort of 15 or 20% known. It's very little correlated with the Hubble constant. This is essentially independent of where you are along that degeneracy line. So if we put in MAP, now the baryon density has gone up a little bit, and the error has gone down to less than 5%. One sigma error is less than 5%. One sigma error on the cold dark matter density is about 8%, a little less than 8%. This is interesting because the week before we released the data, the Big Bang nucleosynthesis value went up. So it, this is from Teitler's group, so. Okay, so there, this is a, now a 9% value from D over H, and we have a 5% value, and they agree to 5%. So it's very impressive.
I should comment, it went up only because Teitler, until then, had never included the Patini and Bowen point deuterium, which was low, corresponding to a higher baryon density. So for example, in the talk I gave here a few weeks ago, the number hasn't changed.
Now, they just measured a, you know, they had never included that, but then they measured one of their own that was low, and so then they included it. So they did include it.
With Patini and Bowen, the best fit value for deuterium was 2.65. With their new deuterium, it's now 2.60. And so their new deuterium hardly changed the result because it happened to agree with the previous mean, including Patini and Bowen.
Yeah, well, there is a new quasar in this that is,
yeah,
it's not the Patini and Bowen, it's their own group.
Right.
And so I think they're including Patini and Bowen and
when
a new quasar
Patini
from their own.
Bowen, their previous result for a deuterium of 3 parts in 10 to the 5 comes down to about 2.6. Their new data point is at 2.5.
Yeah.
So
it, yeah, well, I think the fact that they got a new low point encouraged them to include Patini and Bowen. But yeah, so
exactly.
That's all I'm really saying. But they also have a, you know, they got 5 quasars now. They combined the results. They got a chi-squared of 17 with 4 degrees of freedom. So they're being a little less cocky these days. So this is a supernova results, by the way. Supernova, you want to be in this yellow ellipse. They're red and green are the two different groups. And I'm going to show 5 different models here. Einstein de Sitter, super sandage closed, the best fit, the lambda CDM, and this is a no CDM model. That'll be fun. Okay, so the lambda CDM is a good fit. The quadrupole is very low. Other than that, it's a pretty good fit. And so these are the parameters, H0 of 71, omega lambda 0.73. It's forced to be flat. Dark matter, the total matter density is 0.135. And the baryon density is 0.0224.
What is the error in omega total?
Omega total, this.
You said
omega total is forced to 1. Okay, so let's look if we force the vacuum energy density to 1, then omega total goes up to 1.3, and the densities haven't changed that much.
Of course, lambda is 0.
Lambda is forced to 0. H naught is now 32, so we're down at the lower end of that degeneracy line. It's still a good fit to the CMB data. A little bit off. You know, it's maybe 2 sigma off, so it's not terrible at all. So that degeneracy line is quite degenerate. So the reason you reject this is you don't like H naught of 32, and while you've gotten rid of the vacuum energy density, you've gotten a curvature, and it's no advantage.
How important are those in these fits, those extra blue points? I guess they're from CBI.
Oh, CBI. CBI is a very good complement to COBE, MAP.
Nobody else can get up to the high Ls except CBI?
ACBAR can. I haven't plotted them because they weren't out by November. But basically, CBI is a big interferometer, so they got a 13-meter baseline at 1 centimeter, so they can effectively have something like a 1.5 or 2 arc minute beam. So it's the highest angular resolution experiment. So
MAP can go out that way, right?
MAP's never going to get that far. What MAP's going to do in 4 years is get the error bars out here much smaller.
Planck will get that. Mm-hmm.
Planck will get out to about here with very small error bars. So Planck will do an excellent job here.
Can you flip back one? Okay. So your small deviations at higher L that can be distinguished between these two models, if you measure that really well. Obviously, we're not certain currently.
Yeah. Well, you could do quite a bit better. It's probably worth looking back and forth. You can see the curves are shifting. Some of the data points are shifting, too. Particular boomerang, because they don't have a good calibration. And so what happens here is when I do this fit, I also simultaneously fit for the calibration correction. And so the data points are hopping up and down.
So are you recalibrating everyone to agree with an overall RMS or...
Okay,
what?
No. What's happening is every experiment has an adjustable amplitude. For MAP, that's the amplitude of the power spectrum. For every other experiment, it's the calibration uncertainty. Now, the calibration uncertainties have to be, are limited. You know, so if you experiment says it's got 10% calibration error, and I say I want a 15% shift, then I say, well, that's 1.5 sigma, so I throw 2.25 into chi-squared. Okay, so I, you know, for MAP, you know, I'm assuming MAP's perfectly calibrated, which is pretty close, but there's no contribution to chi-squared from the shift up and down of the MAP data. That's just the overall amplitude. But everything else, shifting relative to MAP, is limited. You know, there's a contribution to chi-squared when you start violating their assumed calibration accuracy.
Right, but you renormalized everybody else based on your calibration.
Right.
If you didn't do that, the points would not agree nearly as well. The error bars would be certainly much larger, the means would shift too.
Well, you know, see, the thing is that the calibration error is a correlated error, so you can't plot it as error bars on points. And so this is a perfectly good way to plot it, but, you know, because you have all these experiments with poor calibration, you get this kind of funny behavior of the data points if you look carefully. Okay, so this is the best fit. So it has both a non-zero curvature and a non-zero vacuum energy density. And it, you know, I mean, that's too many tooth fairies, right? So the other ones, so we've looked at the one tooth fairy models, which would be the Lambda CDM and the Super Sandage Closed. Now we're looking at the two tooth fairy model. It's not enough better to make us like it. That's basically what's...
Yeah, what are you allowing to float here?
Allowing, you know, everything's floating here. This is CMB only, though.
What is the error on the omega total? That's 1.08.
Oh, this is, yeah, it's about
0.01
or something.
So it comes out to be 1.08.
Well, that's the best fit.
Right.
But so it's not.
No theorist has predicted 1.08.
No.
No,
a lot of theorists have predicted that you should have the Einstein de Sitter model, right? Yeah. I would have predicted you should have the Einstein de Sitter model. And so that's the zero tooth fairy model. Okay, so a non-zero curvature or a non-zero vacuum energy density are both really nasty. So you got to be dragged kicking and screaming into wanting one. And to want two of them, we need a bigger deviation between, say, this model, which we think is correct, and this model.
You say the error on the megatotal is 0.01?
For CMB only,
so
with no priors, you know, no H-naught prior.
Just the sense of detection, so you have eight sigma detection of omega not being 1.
What? No. No, 0.1.
Oh, 0.1, you said 0.01.
Well, I think I meant to say 0.1.
Okay.
So.
That's better.
So how can you fill this out? I'm just like
0.1.
On what basis? Eight?
Yeah, get the decimal point right. I may be stumbling when I speak. You know, we can throw this out based on prior information.
Just H.
You can throw it out based on H, or you can throw it out based on the supernova.
That's not good enough to say that.
Well, I guess supernova data is this good if you believe the they don't have systematic errors. And you can also throw this out based on large-scale structure if you believe that, which I don't really. Okay, so if you understand how galaxies form and show up in surveys, then maybe you could throw this out. But this actually, you know, does not give you quite the correct P of K.
If you do just map only, not have all the other data sets in it, then what is your best fit?
Well, I don't know. Haven't looked at that. It's in the parameters paper. I'm not sure that it's actually in the published parameters paper. But this is the non-flat lambda CDM model.
Basically,
okay.
What you said is this has a somewhat better chi-squared than the previous model, the preferred model, but not so much better.
Yeah, you know, so it's maybe 3 units better.
And one extra parameter,
so fundamentally you wouldn't jump for this model anyway, and since it's a very, very nasty parameter, you probably don't want to put it in.
Does this include the polarization?
Yeah, this does.
Oh, this does.
Okay, now.
So essentially throw this out on H0, it's only argument
you're giving out. No, I mean, you can throw it out three different ways, but, you know, basically H0's probably the cleanest way on this.
What is NFL CDM?
Non-flat lambda CDM.
Non-flat lambda, or lambda become L.
Okay. Only because I'm lazy. Okay, so let's talk about what we can kill here. And so the Einstein de Sitter model, we can kill that one. So this is CMB only, it does not fit. It's 8 sigma off.
And that's not just because of CBI?
No, it's not just because of CBI, it's because MAP has measured the amplitudes here correctly, so we actually know the dark matter and baryon densities quite well. And in order to get the peak position right, you have to push the matter density away from where it wants to be. And so then you don't get the amplitudes right. See, we're sitting up too high down here.
But is there systematic errors put on those planes?
Yeah. So systematic errors due to calibration and beam size corrections are applied to all experiments. Of course, anyway, so this one now is dead. You know, it was sort of 2 sigma off before, but now it's 8 sigma off. And then this no dark matter model, well, Stacy McGaw said, well, you could fit the boomerang peak without any dark matter, which you sort of can, but you can't really fit the spectrum. So this is with no dark matter, just baryon density. Pretty ridiculous model overall, because MOND, modification of Newtonian dynamics, doesn't really make any predictions for what the CMB should be doing. So to actually just say, well, CMB fast is correct, because that uses general relativity, but we shouldn't have any dark matter, that's a real mixed bag of assumptions.
This is this Milgram thing?
Yeah.
Okay. So here we have the scale factor versus time for all five of the models I've shown you. The Einstein de Sitter model, the lambda CDM model, both have about the same age of the universe, and that's a significant fact. The other models all have real low, have Hubble constants that are lower, and end up having real long ages. So.
Which are the non-Newtonian ones, the modified Newtonian gravity? Is that what you call?
That's this one here.
This one is modified
Newtonian. So it's got a very large omega lambda. Okay, so we will get a very tight age for flat universes. That's one of the things that was in the press release. So then we have more restrictions on more Baroque models. So quintessence, you can put a restriction on the equation of state. Now this requires putting in all the external data, such as the power spectrum and the Lyman alpha. So all of this is, perhaps less trustworthy than the CMB data. But if you do that, then you get the equation of state has to be less than minus 0.78. So that's the omega lambda is minus 1. So that's the cosmological constant. So it's consistent with being... this is a 2 sigma upper limit. The actual likelihood is we didn't consider models less than minus 1, peaks at minus 1, and then falls off.
And that's also for a constant value of W.
It's always for a constant value of W. We don't have much of a handle on a W dot.
It's my recollection that's not terribly different from pre-map bounds.
I don't know exactly, but it's probably not that different because a lot of the power comes from the large-scale structure in Lyman alpha forest stuff that's existed before. And then the neutrino masses add up to less than 0.7 eV. Again, that's based on using the small-scale information from the 2-degree field galaxy redshift survey. So basically what we're doing is we're looking for this filtering in P of K that's due to a hot dark matter admixture, and we're not seeing it. And so then you can put this limit on the neutrino masses.
And how much of that is due to MAP?
Well, a fair amount is, MAP has improved this considerably because you've got a much better handle on the spectral index for two reasons. One is we measure over a factor of 400 in L with one experiment and one calibration. And the other is that we've measured tau. So now we know where we are in this tau N degeneracy. So if you know the spectral index of the CMB stuff, then you can figure out what you should have had at small scales.
If you forgot that you knew from oscillation data the scale of mass differences and redid this with one massive neutrino, would you get the same bound?
Yeah, you basically get the same number. This is a limit on omega nu. Okay, so omega nu is less than 0.008.
But the damping scale doesn't enter because it'll be...
No, you don't win much there. So okay. What you're doing is just the amplitude drop.
Is that because it's so huge?
What?
Is that because the damping scale is so huge?
Yeah, the damping scale is pretty large. For these small neutrino masses.
How much can we expect these upper bounds of neutrino masses to improve?
Well, with time, if you say with time and allow yourself 10 years, this is going to improve a lot when you get the Planck data, but that's... I don't know about a factor of 10. It's going to improve quite a bit. Just for exactly the reason I just said, Planck will be measuring the power spectrum over a factor of 1,000 in L with one calibration. And also getting right up to where you can see it right in the CMB instead of doing a comparison to P of K. But it's going to be, it's a small effect. I mean, you're just seeing a little drop. It's already limited to be a very small part of the matter, right? Okay, so here's another one of these Monte Carlo Markov chain plots. This is T naught, a derived quantity, versus omega total. And so you can see the degeneracy along, for H naught. And so with the map data in, you have these colored dots. And you can see that if you go to omega total equal to 1, you have a very narrow range of T naughts. And so that's one of the results that was quoted in the press conference, is that for these flat universes, T naught is 13.7 plus or minus 0.2. Hubble constant is 71 plus or minus 5%. This is only 1.5%. The reason this is better than this is because H naught, T naught, the dimensionless factor, is actually anti-correlated with the H naught variation. And then the baryon density is 0.25 baryon per cubic meter for this value. The total matter density is 2.5 yoctograms per cubic meter. Can't quote that as particles per cubic meter because we don't know what the particles are. There's a 2 sigma indication of a running spectral index. That's the least significant number I'll tell you today. And then sigma 8.
What value again? That's a very small error.
On n?
Yeah. So you really believe it's less than 1?
Well, in this running index model, yeah. I mean, it's definitely less than 1 at this scale. But it, and this, for this particular running index, it actually goes from bigger than 1 and then to smaller than 1. So it's a blue tilt at low k and then a red tilt at high k. So that's not what very many models of inflation have predicted. So, but it's only a 2-sigma result. It's pretty obviously the right answer, though, because then that converges at low k and high k. So the basic argument that gives you the Sunyaev-Zeldovich spectrum, or the Harrison-Zeldovich spectrum, is that it has to converge at both ends. And so this makes it even converge better than a power law. Anyway, so this is sort of the basic result. Now I want to talk about something that is a little bit funny, and that's the late ISW effect. So if you have lambda, then the potential actually decays, the linear potential decays. Then the so here's the potential decays at low redshift, and the peak effect is at about a redshift of 0.6. So that means large-scale structure at a redshift of 0.6 will show up in the anisotropy map. And Bond and Crittenden have looked for this and didn't see it with the COBE map and the radio source count map from the National VLA Sky Survey. So what we want to do is improve this. And so I'll advertise an experiment I'm proposing. One is we can do map, get less noisy and higher resolution CMB data. And then we can use a better tracer of large-scale structure, which would be infrared observations of galaxies. Here's the two-mass map of the galaxies. Very clean indication of large-scale structure. And we need to go deeper, however, so we need something with more sensitivity than two-mass, and that could be the Wide Field Infrared Survey Explorer, which some of you may have heard of as NGSS, but it's now called WISE. And so if you happen to see Ed Weiler in the next month, tell him this is a great idea. So another funny thing is the TT autocorrelation is very flat. So this black wiggly curve is very flat here between about 70 degrees and 160 degrees. And COBE DMR showed about the same thing, and that's a little odd. So that would be nice to explain. It requires the low quadrupole to show that, but you need something more than low quadrupole to be that flat. And so then something really funny, Sidney Harris, where the hell did it all come from? The caveman, and now here we are with our big telescopes wondering where the hell did it all come from? Or where the hell did lambda come from? That's what I'm wondering. And just to close up, we got all these papers on the web. If you don't know the address, lambda.gsfc.nasa.gov. And also, that's got all the data on the web. I'm sure you probably downloaded it all already. And this is the conclusion, what I told you. I'll tell you what I told you. So now we're WMAP. Early ionization, reionization has been seen. Lambda CDM fits. Einstein-De-Sitter doesn't. I was surprised by that. Got 4% accuracy on the baryon density, and it agrees within 5% with the Big Bang nucleosynthesis value. And a flat model fit only to the CMB data matches the Hubble constant supernova and large-scale structure data. Okay.